You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that covers all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All comments are current at the time of publication. It's a podcast that's brought to you by the barristers at One Crown Office Row, and this edition is presented by Emma Louise Fenelon.
Listeners will be familiar with the 2021 Supreme Court judgment in Maugham, which lowered the standard of proof for a conclusion in suicide cases and, notably, unlawful killing cases. The ramifications of that judgment are increasingly being felt by those of us practicing in coroner's courts and touched upon in challenges brought against decisions made by coroners. I'm delighted to welcome Matthew Hill of One Crown Office Row back to the podcast to talk about three interesting cases that illustrate this trend. Matt, welcome back.
Thank you very much.
Before we get started, a small request from me. If you enjoy listening to LawPod UK, please take a couple of minutes to let us know what you think, what you like, and what you would like to hear more of. Rosalind, Lucy, and I are always interested in improving the pod and are grateful for all of your feedback, the good, the bad, the ugly. So to begin, Matt, as you pointed out in your recent UK human rights blog, the history of the relationship between the criminal and coronial courts is a fascinating one. In fact, until relatively recently, juries in inquests could find a person guilty of murder, empowering the coroner to issue an arrest warrant and commit them for trial.
Yes, that's right, Emma. The link between the coronial jurisdiction and the criminal jurisdiction has always been inherent to coroner's courts, going back to their medieval origins. There is an inevitability about that because coroners are charged with looking at how people died, when, where, who died, all questions which are also relevant to the criminal jurisdiction where there has been a homicide. The links go way back to Norman times and taxes for killing Normans, which coroners were charged with investigating. And over the centuries, although the role of the coroner has changed, those same questions, who died, when, where, and how, are still at the heart of a coronial inquest and indeed are enshrined in statute now. In the 20th century, you saw a growing development of distinction between the coronial jurisdiction and the criminal jurisdiction, with the criminal jurisdiction taking primacy. That meant that coroners began to suspend inquests in order to allow criminal proceedings to go ahead. And then gradually these distinctions entered into statute. So there was a prohibition on coronial inquests coming up with conclusions or verdicts that were inconsistent with criminal trials. And after 1977, coronial inquests could no longer frame conclusions that appeared to determine questions of criminal liability. So you see a move towards the criminal jurisdiction taking the primary role in determining cases of homicide. But as a result of this historical hangover, you still had the initially verdict, now called conclusion, of unlawful killing, which still remains an option in inquests, albeit in certain circumstances that has been limited. Although following Maugham, the question of how that has changed and whether or not coroners will continue to defer, as it were, to the criminal jurisdiction.
So on that point, the first case I want to ask you about is the inquest into the Shoreham air crash, which concluded late last year and concerned the death of 11 men who died following an aerial display at the 2015 Shoreham Air Show in West Sussex. Why do you say the conclusion in that case is an interesting one?
The pilot in the Shoreham case had been tried in the criminal court for gross negligence manslaughter and had been acquitted. The case then came to an inquest, and it came to an inquest after Maugham. Before Maugham, the pilot's acquittal in the criminal court would have meant that the inquest couldn't find that the people who died were unlawfully killed, because that would be inconsistent with the finding of the criminal court. Critically, both of those findings would have been made to the criminal standard of proof, so beyond reasonable doubt. However, after Maugham, the coroner's court is now making findings on unlawful killing to be civil standard, balance of probabilities. that means that a finding at a coroner's court that, on the balance of probabilities, somebody was unlawfully killed is not inconsistent with a jury acquitting somebody of unlawful killing using the same offence, in this case, gross negligence manslaughter. That is the key change that Maughan has made, and it meant that in Shore, the coroner, who heard the case without a jury, decided that she could make a finding that the people who died were unlawfully killed. That finding was made on the basis of gross negligence manslaughter by the pilot, which was exactly the same offence of which the pilot had been clear. And to add an extra layer, the pilot himself did not give evidence at the inquest. The evidence that was heard was based on the work and investigation and report done by the Air Accident Investigation Branch. The coroner, notwithstanding the fact that the pilot hadn't given evidence, felt that the evidence that she had heard was sufficient for her to conclude that there had been gross negligence and therefore that 11 people who died had been unlawfully killed.
I think in your blog post, you come up with the terrific phrase Schrodinger's defendants and the idea that we are increasingly going to see inquests and inquest findings where this phenomenon appears. Those who the courts have found to not be guilty of the homicide of the person that they are then found, they unlawfully killed. So with that very colourful description in mind, we might move then to Leeson and His Majesty's coroner from Manchester South, in which a divisional court, which included the senior coroner, His Honour Judge Teague KC, considered an unusual case concerning the scope of an inquest in circumstances where a husband had been acquitted for his wife's murder. Can you tell us a little bit about the facts of that case?
The facts of the case were that Miss Leeson was found drowned in a swimming pool while she was on holiday. She had injuries on her body that were consistent both with her being held under the water and with attempts at resuscitation. So there was a question as to the circumstances of her death. Initially, that was looked at by a criminal court, and her husband was prosecuted for her murder. He was acquitted when the judge found that there was no case to answer, and the case then came before the coroner's court. Traditionally, before Maughan, it might not have done, because there would have been no space for the coroner to find that she was unlawfully killed, and therefore nothing that the coroner could add to the investigation at that stage. But after Maughan, there is the possibility, it seems, of a finding of unlawful killing. The case that came before the High Court, the judicial review that came before the High Court, was about the type of evidence that the coroner should allow into the inquest. Initially, the coroner had decided that he was going to exclude the evidence about life insurance policies that were taken out against Miss Leeson's life by her husband. These were of the value of about £3.5 million. That decision was challenged, and it was challenged by the family and by interested parties who were the insurers who had provided those life insurance policies. The High Court, or the Divisional Court, which, as you're saying, included the Chief Coroner, determined that that evidence should have been admitted because it went to the motives of the husband. The only reason why the motives of the husband would be of relevance were if the court was going to be considering, the coroner's court, going to be considering a finding of unlawful killing. So while this case didn't directly address the post-Maughan situation, implied in its finding is that the coroner's court should be looking at the question of whether or not Miss Leeson was unlawfully killed.
Finally, in another decision, the High Court in Mackay and His Majesty's Senior Coroner for South Manchester considered the issue directly. That case concerned the death of Yusuf Mackay, a schoolboy stabbed to death following an altercation with another boy, D. D was acquitted of murder on the basis that he had been acting in self-defence. Matt, can you tell us what's interesting about this judgment?
From a purely legal perspective, it's interesting because here the court directly addresses this question of whether, after Maughan, it is now lawful for a coroner to come to a conclusion of unlawful killing when there has been an acquittal in a criminal case on the same fact. And the court is unequivocally clear that, yes, that is lawful, and indeed the court quashed the ruling that the coroner had given, which was a narrative, really, which had dodged the question of whether or not Yusuf had been unlawfully killed. And they said that wasn't good enough, and the case has now been remitted to be heard again by a different coroner in order to answer that specific question. So whereas the previous cases had proceeded upon the basis that it wouldn't be inconsistent, but had necessarily had to decide it, at least at high court level, in the case of Mackey, it did. And there is now clear, and indeed for coroners, binding authority that an unlawful killing conclusion can be returned following an acquittal in a criminal trial.
Well, for those of us practicing in coroner's courts and having to grapple with the ramifications of Maud, and as you say now, this binding authority, all of us certainly have a view on the wisdom of Maud, which we all know is not without controversy at the time. But putting aside whether you agree or disagree with the judgment itself, what do you say are the things we should bear in mind when considering the impact of Maud in practice?
I think it's important to note one thing right at the start, which is that this is about acquittals at criminal trial. Where somebody is convicted on the criminal standard beyond reasonable doubt, then it would be inconsistent for a subsequent jury or coroner to find that there was no unlawful killing. That's because if the criminal standard is met, then the civil standard must be met. So this isn't an opportunity for those who have been convicted to have another go in the coroner's court in order to get an acquittal. However, where there is an acquittal, there would now seem to be, in pretty much all cases, an opportunity to go to a coroner's court in order to answer the question of how the individual died, because the criminal court hasn't provided an answer. In some cases, this would have happened anyway, particularly where there were arguments about structural failings, for example, police not responding to allegations of domestic violence or local authority not providing sufficient care for somebody who was subsequently preyed upon and murdered. However, it would now seem that in most cases, there is at least an argument that if there is a criminal acquittal, then one can return to the coroner's court and seek an answer as to how it was that the individual died. The first of the cases we've just spoken about, Leeson, is an example of this, because there doesn't seem to be any wider question about failings of safeguarding or anything like that. It is a simple question about whether or not Miss Leeson was unlawfully killed or whether she died as a result of an accident. So there would appear to be scope for a large number of cases to return to coroner's courts in this way. A slightly nuanced element of that is that it's perhaps more likely that those cases will return where there hasn't been a completed criminal trial, such as in Leeson, where it was ended at half-time submissions. In other cases, it may be that prosecutions are either conceded at an early stage and the defendant is acquitted without any evidence being heard. In those circumstances, there is arguably an even stronger argument for the facts to be aired at an inquest, because they haven't been aired at a criminal trial. But the slightly odd outcome of that is that those are the cases where, at least in the decision of the Crown Prosecution Service or the judge, there is less evidence of unlawful killing. That is why the trial hasn't proceeded to a full consideration by the jury. So it ends up with a slightly perverse element where you have the cases where there is less evidence of unlawful killing being the ones that might be more likely to be considered for unlawful killing at a coronial inquest. The final point is this question about whether or not coroner's inquests will identify the person who is accused or said to have committed the unlawful killing. Now, when I wrote the blog, I was barely confident that the situation wouldn't change. At present, in statute, you are not allowed as a coroner to appear to determine liability, criminal liability, on the part of a named person. Now, that may still hold, such that you'll get unlawful killing, but without any names being mentioned. However, I can see an argument that because the coroner is no longer making a determination on the criminal standard, then he or she can't be seen to be appearing to determine a matter of criminal liability. A rather wordy way of saying that this might all be up for grabs as well. In which case, I can see how the family of a victim may wish to seek to persuade a coroner that statutory prohibition no longer applies because of Morn. And therefore, not only can you make a finding of unlawful killing, but you can make a finding of unlawful killing by Mr. X. And that will be a reversion to a situation which hasn't happened in England and Wales, at least, since the 1970s. It's often said that the last person who coroner's court found named to be guilty of a homicide offence was Lord Lucan. Now, I'm not sure if that's right, but certainly there has been a prohibition on naming anybody as being responsible for unlawful killing since 1977. There is now a question of whether or not that's going to hold.
It's fascinating as a question for those of us, particularly those involved in these sorts of inquests at the moment, who are having to deal with this in real time when the law feels very fresh and quite cutting edge. I'm sure you are involved in similar cases, Matt, but I can think of a number of mine where, for example, questions of corporate manslaughter are now on the table and regularly being mooted, and others where they fall in the grey area of what you describe, where, for example, somebody might have been acquitted of murder but found guilty of some lesser offence that touches upon someone's death. And in those circumstances, how does that affect, if at all, a submission that unlawful killing is appropriate in that case, and indeed that person should be formally named on the record? So I think there's all sorts of challenges that are inevitably going to come out of some of the decisions you've discussed today. But thank you so much for taking us through those and flagging some of the questions that we will all want to have in the back of our minds when drafting those late night submissions before a coroner the next day, as some of us are unfortunately in the position of having to do. As usual, we will include links to all the cases mentioned today and, of course, to your original blog post in the blurb accompanying this episode. And a final reminder from me, do let us know what you think of the pod in the comment box linked to this episode, and you will have the eternal gratitude of all of us at LawPod UK in advance for letting us know what you like, dislike, and perhaps would like to see more of on the pod. But thank you again, Matt. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks very much, Emma.
LawPod UK is presented by Emma Louise Fenelon and produced by One Crown Office Row.